Yeah, it's gotta be Bigler's World for the next hour, right here on Sun Sounds of Arizona. That's gonna make me Jim Bigler, at least for some of that hour. What do I got here? Some National Geographic Kids, maybe? A little Ranger Rick, little Science News Explorers. Let's do some Dogo news for kids. That's right. It's for the kids. We do it all for the kids. Sneaky orb weaver spiders use male fireflies to lure more prey, says Sharika Ahmed, who wrote this article. In the wild, animals frequently use deceptive tactics to survive. For instance, some wasps turn spiders into zombie slaves to build intricate nests. Similarly, mouse-eared bats mimic hornet buzzes to avoid being preyed upon by owls. Now, a new study reveals that a crafty orb weaver spider species has found a way to manipulate the mating signals of male fireflies to catch more prey. Let's see if I can pronounce this. The Araneus ventriculus is a nocturnal orb weaver spider found primarily in China, Japan, and Korea. They build their webs in the evening. This is the same time fireflies emerge to attract mates, making them easy prey. Female fireflies emit signal flashes to attract males, while males use two flashes to attract females. Who is this? Jinhua Fu is a researcher at Huaozong Agricultural University in Wuhan, China. He was out studying fireflies when he noticed something interesting. The orb weaver spider webs contained caught many male fireflies, but few females. A closer look revealed that many of the ensnared fireflies were still alive. However, they were emitting a single flash instead of their usual two. It appeared as though they were mimicking female fireflies. To determine if the altered signal was the reason for the larger number of males, Fu and his team decided to investigate further. They found 161 orb weaver webs, randomly divided them into four experimental groups. The first had a male firefly on the web with a spider present. The second group had male firefly, but no spider. And the third had both a male firefly and a spider, but the firefly's light was blocked with black ink. The control group had no fireflies or spiders. The researchers found that most fireflies were trapped by the first group of webs, where both spiders and male fireflies were present. Notably, the spiders wrapped the fireflies in a light layer of silk. This ensured their flashes remained visible. In contrast, other insects, like beetles, were covered in a much thicker layer of silk. Male fireflies were also kept alive longer than other prey. However, they only emitted single, female-like signals when a spider was nearby. This suggested that the spiders may be manipulating the fireflies' signals to attract more prey. Let's see, who is this? Dr. Lee says, "When we removed them from the web and allowed a short recovery period, the male fireflies often resumed their normal multi-pulse flashing pattern." That's the study coordinator, Dr. Lee, or Lai, I'm not sure which it is. The researchers are not sure how the spiders get the fireflies to emit just one flash instead of two, but they suspect it is caused by the spider's venom. Dr. Lee says, "Spiders didn't bite the light-emitting lantern directly. They targeted other soft body parts. Perhaps the spider's venom disrupts normal flashing behavior by interfering with the delivery of oxygen supply." The scientists revealed their findings in Current Biology on August 19th of 2024. They plan to continue their research to uncover more details and search for similar behavior in other animals. Okay, next article here. We'll go to another publication here. What is this here? It is Ranger Rick. Got a little Ranger Rick right here. I'm going to read this. I'm not kidding. Moving On is the title of the first article. And Cecil wrote it. These animals really go the distance. Bum, bum. Some wild animals are homebodies. They stick around their birthplaces their whole lives, but others swim, fly, walk, or crawl to new places, sometimes going quite far. Usually they do this when the seasons change, We call this kind of travel migration. It takes a lot of energy to migrate. So why do it? Lots of different reasons. The wildebeests here, they picture. They're out there being wild and wildebeests. They will travel up to 1,000 miles each year. These African antelope need lots of grass to eat. In the spring, after they've had their babies, the rainy season ends and the grasses dry up. That's when more than a million of them start walking north, following the rain. The trip has many obstacles, including hungry lions on the plains and snapping crocodiles in the rivers they must cross. But when you're hungry, you just keep going. Monarch. Butterflies may seem fragile, but millions of monarchs fly as far as 3,000 miles in a single year. In spring, monarchs in Mexico fly north, stopping along the way to mate and lay eggs on milkweed plants. Once the young hatch and grow up, they continue the cycle, mating and laying eggs farther and farther north from where they hatched. The cycle continues until monarchs reach the northern United States and into Canada. They spend the summer in the north, feeding on nectar, mating, and laying eggs. When the fall nears, a new generation of monarchs begins the journey south. So it's usually the great-grandchildren or even great-great-grandchildren of the monarchs that left Mexico that fly all the way back there for the winter. Then there's the Arctic tern. This crow-sized seabird has the longest migration of any animal on Earth. In summer, the terns nest and raise their chicks in the Arctic. When the season changes, they head south, way south, to Antarctica, on the opposite end of the planet. Over the course of a year, they may fly more than 40,000 miles. A single Arctic tern may travel nearly 1.5 million miles in its lifetime. That's roughly equal to three trips to the moon and back. Then there's, it says krill. I'm not sure why it's twice. Antarctic krill are tiny shrimp-like creatures that are the main food for many animals in the Southern Ocean. Their migration looks a little different from most. Antarctic krill eat phytoplankton, tiny plant-like things that live near the surface of the water. However, that's also where to find krill's predators, such as seals, whales, fish, and penguins. So once their stomachs are full, the krill sink down into deeper waters to avoid those hungry animals. They go up and down many times each night when it's harder for predators to see them. It's like taking the mall elevator up and down between food court and the other levels in the dark. Then there's loggerhead. When loggerhead sea turtles are ready to start new families, they go for an extremely long swim. They travel hundreds, sometimes thousands of miles to return to the shores where they had hatched. There, they mate, they lay eggs, and they head back into the ocean. Scientists believe that they find their way by sensing the Earth's magnetic fields. In the Pacific Ocean, some of these turtles have been tracked swimming 7,500 miles to their nesting spots. Christmas Island red crabs. Every year, 100 million red crabs migrate across Christmas Island off the coast of Australia. The Christmas Island red crabs crawl five miles from the rainforest to the ocean. There they mate, and each female lays up to 100,000 eggs. Then the adult crabs march back into the forest. Soon, millions of babies crawl out of the ocean and walk to the forest. Each baby crab is no bigger than a fingernail. The trip is a hard one for both adult and baby crabs. If they get too much sun or not enough water, they could die along the way. Swarms of ants may attack them, and cars can crush them as they scuttle across a road. Good thing people on the island have built special bridges just for crab crossings. They have also posted signs to keep cars off the road during crab migrations. Then there's the globe skimmer. The globe skimmer is a kind of dragonfly found all over the world. Scientists think that some of these dragonflies from India fly over the Indian Ocean to reach East Africa. How could such an insect that weighs less than a paperclip cross an entire ocean? Well, it's possible that special winds high up in the sky help push the insects along. These skimmers make this dangerous journey because they lay their eggs in shallow pools of fresh water. When those in India dry up, they go all the way to Africa to find what they need. And they've got the bar-tailed godwit. What the heck is that? Imagine running for 9 straight days without stopping. Impossible, it says. Well, some bar-tailed godwits do something like that when they migrate, but they fly instead. Many of these shorebirds nest and feed in Alaska in the summer. As fall nears, they fly south to New Zealand, where the seasons are opposite and the summer is just starting. That's a trip of around 7,000 miles. Amazingly, they never stopped to eat or sleep. Also, they flap their wings the whole time instead of gliding or soaring. For you, that would be like adding jumping jacks to that 9-day run. And they have the sockeye salmon. Sockeye salmon spend several years growing up in the northern Pacific Ocean. Then each year, thousands of them head toward the freshwater rivers and streams where they hatched years before. There, the females lay eggs that the males then fertilize. The fish use their sense of smell to find their way. It's not an easy journey. They swim upstream through water flowing against them, many for hundreds of miles. They sometimes even leap up waterfalls to reach their goal. I got a picture of them doing that, zipping up a waterfall. And last one they got here is the gray whale. Meet the gray whale, which has one of the longest migrations of any mammal on Earth. Thousands of these ocean giants, each maybe as long as a tractor trailer, live in the Pacific Ocean off North America's west coast. They spend summers in the Arctic waters. When the temperature starts to drop each year, they swim south to Mexico for the winter. There, many mate and give birth to calves. The whale's round trip may be as long as 14,000 miles. I got a picture of a gray whale here. It has paused in its swim to breach or fling its body up out of the water. Luckily for whale watchers, gray whales swim close to the shoreline, so it's not too hard to catch glimpses of sights like this. It's breaching. Okay, let's do one more article here. From Ranger Rick. It's great to be gross is the name of this article by Kathy Cranking. And it gives us a warning. Warning. This story may gross you out. But don't worry. The things that make hagfish, that's all one word, hagfish, the things that make them gross are also the things that make them great. Hope you are still reading this and didn't scream and turn the page, it says. After all, there's a lot to learn about the monstrous-looking hagfish. Hagfish live in burrows on ocean floors around the world. They can be just inches from head to tail or as long as you are tall, though most are a couple of feet long. These creepy fish are sometimes called slime eels, but that name is only half right. A hagfish isn't an eel, but it can be super slimy. Along with the sides of its body, the hagfish has tiny openings. If it is threatened by a predator, such as a shark, it oozes huge amounts of slime from the openings. The slime can clog up the shark's gills, which makes it hard for the shark to breathe, and that gives the hagfish a chance to get away. When a hagfish slimes an enemy, the hagfish ends up covered in gooey slime too, but that's no problem. The hagfish can tie its body into a knot and then slide the knot down its body to squeegee off the slime. And if some of the slime gets in its nose, the hagfish just sneezes it out. Speaking of the hagfish's nose, where is it? That big hole on the hagfish's face is its nostril. One nostril. Below the nostril is the hagfish's mouth, and surrounding the mouth are pointy, tentacle-like feelers. The hagfish uses the nostril and feelers to find its food. That brings us to the hagfish's eating habits. If you thought sliming was gross, keep reading, it commands me. You are about to be even more grossed out. Bad dinner guest. A hagfish doesn't have very nice table manners. First of all, there's what it eats, mostly dead or dying animals. Then there's how it eats. It burrows inside an animal and eats it from the inside out. And it has the word ew. Hagfish doesn't have jaws, but it does have a tongue-like mouth part that is covered with sharp, pointed teeth. The hagfish uses this to scrape away at the
body of a dead animal until it makes a hole, and then it burrows face first into the creature's body, eating its way as it goes. Even though all that may seem to gross you, hagfish do an important job. They're part of nature's cleanup crew. They help keep the ocean floor clean so that dead animals don't just pile up, and that helps keep the ocean healthy. Baggy body wrap. The hagfish's slime trick can keep it safe from some enemies, but other hagfish predators, such as seals, dolphins, and octopuses, may not be bothered by the slime. So the hagfish has another trick up its slimy sleeve: loose skin. The hagfish's skin fits like an oversized sock around its body. If the hagfish is lucky, an attacking enemy will only bite through the skin, missing the hagfish's inner parts. The skin wounds are easier to recover from, and the hagfish can live to be gross another day. And it says, let's hear it for hagfish. That's the end of the article, but it says on the bottom, hagfish have been around for 300 million years, but a number of hagfish species are now in danger of becoming extinct. In some places, too many hagfish are caught for meat or their skin, which can be made into leather. They also get caught in nets meant to catch other kinds of fish. To highlight the importance of hagfish, people have created National Hagfish Day. Sorry, but it's already come and gone. October 16th. Okay, let's go to another publication. Let's do a little Frontiers for Young Minds. How Our Body Experiences Shape Our Thinking. Venera Kasaj, Kobini Moeller, and Dragan Trinic wrote this article here. Do our bodies influence how we think and learn? It starts here. Have you noticed how some people feel sad on rainy days, or how many people, even adults, use their fingers to count? Or maybe you have noticed how we refer to some people as warm and others cold, and use many other physical and bodily metaphors in everyday language, like feeling down, staying on top of things, lend a hand, and so on. Well, such metaphors describe a situation or state by connecting bodily experiences with it. This idea of embodiment or grounding of cognition or thinking in body experiences is fascinating because it provides a new perspective on how the mind works. In the mid-20th century, scientists thought our minds processed information like computers do. They believed that we used abstract codes in our heads to solve problems, similar to a computer's language of zeros and ones. According to this view, the body plays a limited role in thinking. Our brains were seen as computer hardware and our minds as software. But embodied cognition is different. Instead of imagining our minds as software, using abstract ideas to reason, embodied cognition argues that cognition is shaped by our bodily experiences and our interactions with the physical world. To break this down with an example, imagine experiencing something new, like learning to play a new sport or a new board game. When this happens, your mind records memories about the experience. However, what is recorded includes all sensations you experience in that moment, including perceptual, that's what you see, feel, smell, hear, and taste, motor, how you move, emotional and introceptive sensations and or states, such as which body parts were involved, etc., or how it felt to do it. So the recording involves your individual, personal sense of performing the activity. Now, when you encounter a similar situation in the future, your brain replays parts of the original recordings to help you draw on this experience when dealing with a new situation. This happens without you being aware of it. For example, thinking about using a hammer or even just seeing it activates the same parts of your brain that are active when you actually use a hammer. This means that your mental image of a hammer includes a simulation of previous experiences of using it. Making sense of abstract ideas. We use our perceptual, motor, and introceptive sensations to make sense of the world. Such connections may be clearer for concrete ideas like using a hammer, in which everyday experiences help shape our understanding. However, the way we use these sensations may be less clear for abstract ideas like justice, or mathematical ideas like numbers. Unlike a hammer, which we can directly observe in use or even use ourselves, abstract ideas are more difficult to observe or experience in everyday life. For example, it is difficult to point at justice, and some abstract ideas are impossible to observe with our senses. For example, we cannot see infinity. So how do we make sense of abstract ideas? The question is a big challenge for every theory of cognition, but there is a possible answer. Embodied cognition suggests that to grasp abstract ideas, we connect them to our previous experiences. For example, to understand justice, we might recall situations in which we have experienced fairness or unfairness and their consequences, such as characteristics of a situation that we felt unfair. Try it. Think about your idea of justice, about something that was unfair, and what do you remember? For example, when someone cheats in a game, several things might happen at the same time. You see the unfair move, which is a perceptual experience. At the same time, you might have a motor experience, like sitting still in your chair and feeling tense while the cheating player moves around confidently. Emotionally, you might feel frustrated or angry about what is happening. Simultaneously, you could notice an interoceptive sensation, like your heart racing or your stomach tightening, in response to the unfairness. All these experiences can occur together, shaping how you react to the situation. This way, even abstract ideas can be grounded in perceptual, motor, emotional, and interoceptive experiences. Our bodies and real-life experiences of interactions with the physical world help us make sense of both concrete and abstract ideas. Learning new ideas. What does embodied cognition mean for learning new ideas, for instance, at school? Think about learning abstract ideas like in mathematics. Mathematics is often seen as abstract, but embodied cognition implies that real-life body experiences help us to master not only basic mathematical ideas, ergo numbers, but also more advanced mathematical ideas. For the basics, brain research tells us that when we are handling numbers and doing simple arithmetic, there is an overlap in the parts of the brain that are also active when we move our fingers. Ever noticed how younger kids naturally start using their fingers for counting and calculations? Well, it turns out they naturally establish that connection because it helps them learn numbers and calculate. You can read more about what movements teach us and brain function here. I have to click that, but I'm not going to. Using fingers seems to associate mathematical ideas with bodily experiences and thus things we see and do, making basic mathematics easier to grasp and understand. Can we also understand advanced mathematics by moving our bodies? Yes, it says, with an exclamation point. This might be difficult to believe, especially because a math class usually involves sitting quietly. Nevertheless, there's a story about Terence Tao, one of the leading mathematicians of today, that illustrates this point. Terence is a professor of mathematics at the University of California, Los Angeles, and a winner of the Fields Medal, the highest prize in mathematics. When discussing one of his mathematical discoveries, Professor Tao mentioned that to grasp a particularly difficult mathematical idea, it helped him to lay down on the floor and roll around. Why did he do this? Well, he was trying to invent something like a mathematical description of waves rotating on top of one another. He tried pretending to be the thing he was aiming to mathematically describe, and rolling around helped his thinking. In other words, the act of rolling around was similar enough to the mathematical problem he was working on that rolling in a particular way helped him see things in a new way. Of course, this does not mean that all students should roll around to learn math. Not everyone will have the same experimental and mathematical background that made this movement meaningful to Professor Tao. Instead, this story shows that bodily actions can help us make sense of even highly advanced mathematics. And more generally, although students in the classroom are expected to sit down and work quietly, this restrictive behavior is not the norm for mathematicians, who often walk around, change positions, and gesture while trying to understand mathematics. Embodiment shapes our thinking. The idea of embodied cognition invites us to reevaluate how we see the impact of our senses, movements, and feelings while interacting with the world. When we realize just how much our body shape is thinking, we gain valuable insights into how we learn and make sense of the world. In school, this perspective emphasizes how hands-on activities and learning through acting out can be effective components of learning even abstract subjects like mathematics. Okay, let us go to News for Kids. It's newsforkids.net. Chepin Gedich is the name of this person, crushes women's marathon record. This happened in Chicago, Illinois. Two Sundays ago, Ruth Kepenetich of Kenya set a new world record for the fastest marathon ever run by a woman, finishing in 2 hours, 9 minutes, and 56 seconds. She's the first woman ever to finish a marathon in under 2 hours and 10 minutes. A marathon is a 26.2-mile running race. It's a hard race. Runners must not only be fast, but they must be strong enough to keep their speed up over a very long distance. The Chicago Marathon is one of 6 major marathons held around the world every year. Chepin Gedich is very familiar with the Chicago Marathon. She's won it twice before. She has a history of doing well in Chicago. She won the race in 2021 and 2022. Last year, she finished second. In 2022, she ran her best marathon time ever, 2 hours, 14 minutes, 18 seconds. It was the fourth fastest time for a woman's marathon in history. This year, Chepin Gedich was focused on one thing, breaking the women's marathon world record. "I've fought a lot thinking about the world record," she says. She is 30 years old. She ran fast from the very beginning. She finished the first 3.1 miles in just 15 minutes. She said she wasn't sure she could keep up the pace, but she managed to do it, running almost every mile in less than 5 minutes. By the halfway point, Chepin Gedich was 14 seconds ahead of the next fastest runner, Satumi Kabidi of Ethiopia. By 18 and a half miles, she was nearly 2 minutes ahead of Kabidi. However you pronounce that. Chepin Gedich was going so fast that for much of the marathon, she was running with the fastest men in the race. As it turns out, only 9 men finished the marathon ahead of her. Chepin Gedich's goal was to break the marathon world record set by, another interesting name, Tigst Asifa of Ethiopia last year. Asifa ran the Berlin Marathon in 2 hours, 11 minutes, and 53 seconds. Chepin Gedich managed to beat Asifa's record by nearly 2 minutes. The result surprised many people who thought the marathon time of 2 hours, 10 minutes was impossible for a woman. She says, "I'm very proud of myself," in an interview. "This is my dream that has come true." Kabidi finished the second with a time of 2 hours, 17 minutes, 32 seconds. Irene Cheptai, that is also from Kenya, came in third with a time of 2 hours, 17 minutes, and 51 seconds. Chepin Gedich earned $100,000, yikes, for winning, and an extra $50,000 for setting a new record for the Chicago Marathon. Chepin Gedich said her world record run was in memory of Kelvin Kiptum. Last year, Mr. Kiptum set the men's marathon world record in Chicago. Sadly, Mr. Kiptum died in a car accident just a few months later. Before the race began, runners held a moment of silence for Mr. Kiptum. This year, the Chicago Marathon's men's race was won by John Korir of Kenya with a time of 2 hours, 2 minutes, and 44 seconds. He was followed by Mohamed Essa of Ethiopia, 2 hours, 4 minutes, 39 seconds, and Amos Kipturo of Kenya, 2 hours, 4 minutes, and 50 seconds. Okay. Let's move to another publication here on Bigler's World, right here on Sun Sounds of Arizona. What do we got here? Some Sports Illustrated for kids. This one's just for the kids. Let's see. There was a moment, is the name of this article. In June, shortly after the draft, when Thunder general manager Sam Presti sat down to address the media, before he discussed his team's picks, he thanked his scouts, the people whose legwork and time spent traveling helped Presti decide who to select. And he says, "The evaluators and the scouts spend so much time away, travel all over the world," he said. "There's a lot of rental car returns at 5 in the morning, connecting flights to far-off lands. There's a million stories like that." Well, they had better get used to it because they're going to be remarkably busy for the next several years. Oklahoma City has amassed a staggering bounty of draft picks, as many as 27, including 12 first-rounders, in the next 5 years. That kind of draft capital is the envy of every GM who's trying to rebuild an NBA team. But there's a catch. The Thunder aren't rebuilding. In fact, they might just be the best team in the league. Presti has constructed a roster that is remarkably balanced. The offense built around MVP runner-up Shai Gilgeous-Alexander was third in the NBA in efficiency last year. The defense, anchored by 7-foot-1-inch rim protector Chet Holmgren and forward Jalen Williams, ranked fourth, and the Thunder did all of that with only one rotation player over the age of 25. Presti made the team even tougher and more experienced in the offseason, acquiring all-defensive guard Alex Caruso. "I looked up highlights on YouTube of them playing." Oh, this is Caruso saying.
"I looked up the highlights on YouTube of them playing," Caruso said when he was traded. "I was really excited. I'm excited to add to that."
Oklahoma City is, by NBA standards, a small city. Unlike New York or Los Angeles, it's not a glitzy destination for free agents, so the Thunder have historically built through the draft. And Presti is very good at that. From 2007 to 2009, he selected 3 future Hall of Famers. You got your Kevin Durant, Russell Westbrook, and James Harden. More recently, he snagged Holmgren 2nd overall in 2022, then got Williams later in that draft. The current group is eerily similar to Durant's Thunder. They're young and tight-knit. Holmgren and Alexander are especially close, which was evident in their TV commercial in which they sang a parody of a Christina Aguilera song. Let's see, Durant and the crew. Did I say Durant? He's Kevin Durant. Durant and his crew would go eat wings together and then play video games until bedtime. Durant said in 2010, "Every day I wake up, I feel blessed to be here." But Presti ultimately couldn't keep the team together. They made the finals in 2012, but lost to the Heat in 5 games. Now, though, Presti not only has a young core, but also the tools to find complementary pieces. On draft night back in June, he packaged 5, and it has a parentheses exclamation point, second-round picks, and sent them to the Knicks for the rights to Dylan Jones, a player who might have been available much later. And it's not like the Thunder need much. Holmgren, who missed the entire 2022-23 season with a foot injury, is a basketball unicorn. Yes, I said a basketball unicorn. And a quadruple-double waiting to happen. He can shoot from anywhere. He made 37% of his threes last year, has the passing touch of a guard, and is long enough to grab any rebound or block any shot. Add in the two-way talents of Alexander and Williams, and you've got a team that won 57 games last year, 2 years after winning just 24. Their inexperience showed in the playoffs when Dallas knocked OKC out of the 2nd round. So the scouts will continue to return rental cars at the crack of dawn as they travel the world looking for a player or two to push the team over the hump. And like with most contending teams, there's not a sense of urgency, the feeling that the title window is closing. The Thunder is rolling in Oklahoma City, and it's going to be loud for a long time. Okay. Next article here. In Sports Illustrated for Kids. This article entitled, "How It Started, How It's Going." Who is this by? Mark Bechtel. Plenty of NFL players had big seasons back in 1982. Chargers quarterback Dan Fouts, there's the name from a long time ago, threw 2,883 yards in the shortened ninth game season, and translates to 5,446 in a 17-game season. His top target was Wes Chandler. He had 1,032 receiving yards in eight games, the equivalent of 2,193 in a full season. But the MVP award went to Washington's Mark Mosley, a kicker. Now, we're not disparaging Mosley. He made 20 of 21 field goal attempts. But if the voters who were wowed by the performance could see that state of kicking now, their minds would be totally blown. Mosley began his career in the early 1970s, when most kickers booted the ball straight on. When he retired after the 86 season, he was the last of that breed. Every kicker since has used a soccer-style approach. Now there's a new trend emerging. Soccer players are making the transition to football relatively late in life. And if Brandon Aubrey of the Cowboys keeps kicking like he has since the start of last season, we're going to be seeing a lot more crossover cases. A lifelong soccer player, Aubrey was drafted in the first round of the MLS Super Draft out of Notre Dame by Toronto FC back in 2017. After two seasons toiling in lower divisions, he retired from soccer. As he was considering what to do with his life after soccer, Aubrey was watching an NFL game with his wife. She saw a kicker and suggested Aubrey could do his job just as well. So Aubrey signed up for a free class in Dallas with Brian Egan, the founder of the Performance Kicking Academy. Egan's classes were normally taken by kids in middle school and high school. After Aubrey kicked, he had what Egan called a grown man conversion about whether or not Aubrey had a future. They decided he did and started working together to transition from football to football. Let's see, says Egan, "There's 100 different ways to strike a soccer ball. They put a spin on the ball. There's passing, shooting, long kicks. And then when you translate that into football, it's just one specific ball strike that you're looking for each time." It's an important one. In 1982, when Mosley was MVP, teams made an average of 1.2 field goals per game and converted 68.2% of their kicks. Last year, those numbers were 1.7 and 85.9%. And distance has never been more significant. In Mosley's MVP campaign, the longest kick he made, yikes, was 48 yards, and he didn't even attempt a 50-yarder. Last year, when Aubrey was 36 of 38 kicks in his first season with the Cowboys, he made all 10 of his attempts from 50 or longer. And in week one of this year, he had a 66-yarder nullified by a penalty. As participation in youth football dwindles, teams are certain to explore new avenues for players. Thanks to Aubrey, that will include soccer teams. Next article here, sticking with Sports Illustrated for Kids. Rookies, it says, give them a rest. Kip Shormore wrote this article. Sometimes you can't help but wish a player had started their career earlier. Randy Johnson didn't get in a full major league season until he was an ancient 25 years old. But he ended up with 4,875 career strikeouts. If only he had started at a more reasonable age, he could have been just the second pitcher to fan 5,000 batters. Dennis Rodman began his NBA career at 25 and didn't average double-digit rebounds until he was 29. Kurt Warner became a starting quarterback at 28. Speaking of Hall of Fame QBs, what if Aaron Rodgers hadn't been blocked by Brett Favre until he was 25? Or if Steve Young hadn't been stuck behind Joe Montana until his 30s? By age 9, it has in parentheses here, I had already overtaken Buzz Beamer as this magazine's most prominent personality. These kinds of tantalizing hypotheticals don't come up as much anymore. Any highly touted young quarterback will sit four at most half a season, not a decade like poor Steve Young. This year, three rookie QBs were named Week 1 starters: Jaden Daniels, Bo Nix, and Caleb Williams. For those of us who love a long career with the biggest pile of accumulated stats possible, it's an exciting time to be a fan. At least it was until Week 1 actually happened. Nix tossed two interceptions and no touchdowns. Williams threw for 93 yards. Daniels managed the best debut of the three, 184 yards passing with two rushing touchdowns. And if for some reason it says womp womp, maybe there's a value in sitting for a while. College offenses and off-season, when it says offenses, college offenses and off-season training programs have come a long way. In theory, that means quarterbacks come to the NFL more game-ready than ever. But that's not all that's going on. No, no. Consider this familiar tale. An owner hires a new coach to revive a struggling franchise. The coach hitches his wagon to a first-round signal caller. The young passer gets touted as the team's savior, and the coach, hired on the promises of a quick turnaround, feels pressure to deploy this potential superstar to find out what he has and change his team's fortunes. Few coaches in today's NFL have the job security to ignore antsy fans and hand a young QB the clipboard for a year or two. And with quarterbacks going higher and higher in the draft, six in the first 12 picks this year, fewer prospects even end up on teams with a decent vet who can mentor them. No wonder, given these incentives, that nobody learns from the bench anymore. And when young players are getting to play, they're not necessarily improving. Learning on the job can be tough. Mistakes can be a great teacher, but too many mistakes too soon on a big stage can be demoralizing. Take an example from another sport, Cliff Lee. A fairly highly touted prospect, Lee was one of four players sent from Montreal to Cleveland in the infamous Bartolo Colon trade back in 2002. Cleveland called up the young pitcher that year. He had an up-and-down 5 years before the team sent the struggling Lee, then 28, back down to the minors. When he returned to the Bigs in 2008, he went 22-3. With a 2.54 ERA and won the American League Cy Young Award. He played six more seasons as one of baseball's top hurlers. Viewed through the lens of Lee's career, Johnson seems more like a blueprint than a what-if. Had Cleveland sent an inconsistent young Lee to AAA sooner, would he have blossomed sooner? Maybe a chance to break into the majors with a little more seasoning like Johnson would have elevated a very good career to a slam-dunk Hall of Fame case. Every league has examples of dudes who put up big numbers as rookies and then never repeated them. Robert Griffin III, Jahlil Okafor, Nail Yakupov, etc. Lots of playing time and raw talent can combine for a pretty nice first year. Being the go-to guy on a bad team, though, means a rookie has no one to learn from. They miss out on not just strategic tips, but also examples of how to prepare and practice to ensure that they're in it for the long run. I hope Jaden Daniels, Bo Nix, and Caleb Williams have great careers, but it's a lot of pressure to perform right away. Not everyone has the raw Kip ability to come out firing and never let up. And then ask here at the bottom here, what's your hot take? Do you have a question for Kip Shormore, a complaint, a topic he should write about in future issue? You can send your letters to Kip's Treehouse, based editor, mail to Kip. That's online. Kip.Shormore, that's S-H-O-R-E-M-O-R-E, at S-I, that's sportsillustrated.com. Okay, next up here on Bigler's World, let's switch over to Time Magazine for Kids. That's right, it's Time for Kids. Career Values is the name of this article by Lillian Stone. I'm Lillian Stone. Young people want a workplace that matches their values. That's according to a survey that was done by the National Society of High School Scholars this year. The organization asked more than 10,000 people what they're looking for in a career. Everyone surveyed was born between 1996 and 2010. The survey found that people in this age group want to work for responsible companies. They want to see employees treated fairly. They also want work-life balance. Many people reported liking the idea of jobs in which they can help others. Nearly half were interested in health care. Respondents listed St. Jude Children's Research Hospital as the most desirable place to work. The hospital ranked higher than big companies like Amazon or Google. Many people who are younger than those surveyed are still deciding what they want in the future. Time for Kids spoke to one of them, Caden Estrada. He's 11 years old, lives in Pennsylvania. And he says, I want to do what I love, Caden said, and I want to make money. What are your career values? And what's in your wallet, for that matter? What have they got here? An article called Seeking the Truth. Who wrote this? Time for Kid reporter Milo Shushan. It says right here, TFK Kid reporter Milo Bouchon read, a strange thing happened in Cherry Hall, and interviewed its author, Jasmine Warga. And it commands me to read Milo's thoughts below. Ever since Rami Ahmad started sixth grade, he's felt invisible. Having no friends to hang out with, Rami spends his afternoons in an art museum. He waits for his mom to finish work there. When a painting disappears, Rami's mom is a suspect. So is Rami. With the help of a turtle named Agatha, a ghost named Blue, and a classmate named Veda, Rami must race to clear his mom's name and his own. It turns out that the thief and the motive are not what they seemed. Ooh. A Strange Thing Happened in Cherry Hall is the latest book from Jasmine Warga. She's the author of the Newbery Honor book, Other Words for Home. This is her first mystery. When I spoke with Warga, she says she relates to Rami. As a kid, she said, I really wanted other people to see me, but I was scared about being seen in the wrong way. Warga wants her readers to know they deserve to be seen. And sometimes, she says, you have to be brave in order to be seen. A Strange Thing Happened in Cherry Hall is a captivating novel. The characters have to solve the mystery of a stolen painting, but each of them also solves the personal mystery of how to be seen by others. As Warga puts it, figuring out who you are and where you belong in the world is also a mystery. Now, if only we all had a wise and observant turtle named Agatha to help us figure it out. Sorry. Let's see, next article here. On the Case, sticking with Time for Kids. This is put together by Time for Kid Kid reporter Vivian Goldhirsch. Let's see what it is. Vivian Goldhirsch read The Sherlock Society and interviewed its author, James Ponti. And it commands me once again to read Vivian's thoughts below, which I will do. The Sherlock Society is a book about four kids in Miami, Florida, who start a detective agency. Siblings Alex and Zoe? Sherlock, they love mysteries, as does their grandpa, who used to be an investigative reporter for the city newspaper. Alex and Zoe and their friends study one of his old cases, which leads them to a shocking discovery. As the characters sleuth around the massive scandal, readers will feel as if they're in the back seat of Grandpa's car. This book is not just a mystery, it's an experience you can relate to. The writing helps you feel all of the characters' emotions. The Sherlock Society is the latest page-turner from James Ponti, the best-selling author of four middle-grade book series. Ponti has wanted to be a writer since he was in the fifth grade. He's always loved mysteries. His favorite stories as a kid were about Sherlock Holmes. He also loved From the Mixed-Up Files of Mrs. Basil E. Frankweiler. Before writing The Sherlock Society, Ponti was unsure how to proceed. He wanted his next book to be a mystery, but he didn't know what the plot would be. And he says, I went for a walk around by the lake by my house, he says. There are 10 benches on the lake, and I made a rule. I said, I'm going to sit at a bench, and I'm going to ask myself a question about the book, and I can't get up until I give a good answer. Bench to bench, he got his first draft. The Sherlock Society is an amazing read that you will surely add to your favorite books ever list. I did, says Vivian Goldhirsch. And there is one more article, I believe, in Time for Kids. Forecasting with AI. Andrew R. Chow wrote this for Time magazine and was adapted by the Time for Kid editors. It goes like this. On October 9th, Hurricane Milton became the fifth hurricane in 2024 to make landfall in the mainland United States. Storms like this grow more frequently and more intense, so meteorologists are hard at work forecasting and tracking them. Artificial intelligence is playing an important role in that process. AI advantages. For years, meteorologists have built digital models of storms. They use data gathered by planes, satellites, and buoys. These models can take hours to produce updated forecasts. But AI models used vast amounts of data from previous storms to recognize patterns. They find trends that most humans can't, and they do so very quickly. This year, AI models made accurate storm-related predictions within seconds and days in advance. Let's see what the article continues. Matt Lanza, he's a meteorologist. He's based in Houston, Texas. In the week before Hurricane Milton made a landfall, Lanza says older models accurately predicted where in Florida the storm would hit, but AI models probably picked up on that potential outcome a good 12 to 18 hours before, he says. Those hours can make a big difference to people preparing for a storm's impact. The AI program GraphCast, is that right? GraphCast predicted that Hurricane Beryl would hit Texas on July 8th. A traditional model would predict it would hit Mexico. GraphCast was right. The team behind it won an engineering prize. One of the judges called GraphCast a revolutionary advance. In September, the AI program AIFS predicted Hurricane Francine's path as the storm hit Louisiana. It accurately gave Lanza the confidence to tell his viewers in Texas that the storm likely wouldn't be an issue for them. He says this, "The consistency was incredible." That's Lanza talking. Room to grow. The National Hurricane Center, or NHC, uses AI in its forecasting. Who is this talking? NHC Deputy Director Jamie Rome told NBC Miami, "The sophistication of AI has dramatically improved, and it continues to improve." Despite the technology's success, there are still hiccups. Lanza says that AI models struggle to predict a storm's intensity and how much precipitation will fall. That's why it's important for meteorologists to use AI along with other forecasting tools. "We're not just turning the reins over to these things and saying, 'Make me forecast,'" he says. Meteorologists are scientists who study Earth's atmosphere and weather patterns in order to make predictions. They can warn people about severe events. Ashley Ruiz, she's a meteorologist. She works in Baton Rouge, Louisiana. In 2022, Ruiz told Time for Kid Kid reporter Cash Daniels that one of her favorite parts of the job is getting out in the community, meeting the families who saw the forecast and were able to get to safety. It's amazing knowing I helped make that happen. Okay, let's go over to another publication. I haven't done any science news. Explorers. Scientists say deep fake. It's deep fake time. Sophisticated AI technology can produce fake but realistic looking images and more. You get a picture. What is this here? In 2023, deep fake images of Pope Francis wearing a white puffer jacket, they got a picture of it here, went viral. While the images were created with AI, many people online were tricked into thinking the pictures were real photos. Looks pretty real to me. Here's the article. Katie Grace Carpenter wrote this here. Deep fake. A deep fake is a realistic fake image, video, or audio clip created by artificial intelligence, or AI. The term deepfake comes from deep learning and fake. Deep learning is a type of AI is the type of AI used to make this media. Deepfakes have some practical use.
Consider someone making a sequel to a movie from many years ago. The actors might look different today, but filmmakers can use deepfake technology to show an actor today looking as they did in the first movie. But deepfakes also cause problems. Many actors, for instance, are concerned that people could use their images to create new movies without their permission. Deepfakes can also contribute to the spread of false information. In 2024, for example, fraudsters created a deepfake of President Joe Biden's voice. The audio clip sounded like Biden asking people not to vote in New Hampshire's presidential primary elections. Some people who received phone calls with this fake voice were convinced to skip voting. In another scam, people made deepfake ads of celebrity Selena Gomez appearing to promote cookware. The problem? She knew nothing about these ads. It wasn't actually her in them. Using digital tools to alter photos, videos, and audio isn't new, but deepfakes represent a new kind of digital media. For one thing, rather than tweaking existing media, deepfakes are easily created from scratch. For another, AI now allows non-experts to easily make such images and audio. That makes it possible for anyone to create deepfakes of people saying or doing things they never did. And public figures aren't the only victims. People can use AI to make deepfakes of ordinary people to bully them, scam them, and more. Let's see, is that it? I am out of time. This is Bigler for Bigler's World. I'll read with you next week. Until then, bye-bye, everybody. Bye-bye.